I told the stage manager it was a gastric emergency. Out the door, cut around the block to the corner bodega to grab a bottle of Pepto. Oh, I almost forgot. I was in costume. Cop number two. Hey folks, how you doing? I'm Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster. You've tuned into the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Wonderful, wunderbar to have you with me. Hillary Queen's Mystery Magazine and Richard Helms bring us our first story. It's called Spear Carriers. There's a scene in a movie I saw once in which a bunch of musicians are kvetching about working some horrible schlocky job. One of them, fed up, exclaims, "I went to Juilliard for this." Another pipes up, "We all went to Juilliard for this." Every kid who ever starred in a high school play dreams of one day taking a bow in a Broadway theater. Nobody ever expects they'll do it as Spear Carrier number two. That's me. Spear Carrier number two. Well, okay, not exactly Spear Carrier. I'm actually Cop number two in the Broadway revival of Wait Until Dark. My buddy Sam is Cop number one, and yeah, we both went to Juilliard for this. Each evening we show up for call around 6:30. On weekends we do two a day. We check in at the stage door, head on to the dressing room, get into our costume and makeup, and sit around reading a book or watching a Knicks game for the greater part of 3 hours, until the climactic end of the second act, when we burst onto the set and recite our collective five lines. I get two, Sam gets three, that's why Sam is Cop number one. What can I say? We're working actors. We're in a Broadway play. It mostly pays the bills. Uber pays the rest. Everyone has to pay their dues. I mean, Olivier must have done a walk-on somewhere, right? But I'm not here to belabor the trials and tribulations of a spear carrier. That's incidental. Well, not exactly incidental, because none of this would have happened if I hadn't been cast. But I get ahead of myself. It was a Tuesday evening. The theater is dark on Monday, so Tuesday is kind of our Monday, and any Monday sucks. Sam and I had done a double date the night before with a couple of dancers in the chorus of a musical in the theater next door. Nice girls, great legs. We ate Italian, not great Italian, because we're cash-deprived actors. Between the abundance of garlic and cheap Chianti, I was still a little hungover when I arrived at the theater the next evening. It was an hour to curtain and at least three until I needed to be on stage, so I cleared it with the stage manager, told him it was a gastric emergency, and cut around the block to a corner bodega to grab a bottle of Pepto. Oh, I almost forgot. I was in costume. Cop number two. I grabbed the pink bottle off the shelf and headed for the cashier. As soon as I set the bottle in front of him, I realized my wallet was in my street clothes back in the theater. I prepared to make an apology and tell the guy I'd be right back. He pushed the bottle back toward me. "On to house," he said. "What? Come on, man," he said, leaning in. "Don't make this embarrassing. Thank you for your service." What could I do? It would be impossible to refuse him. I thanked him and hustled back to the theater. Sam lounged on the couch in the dressing room, reading the sides for an audition he had the next day. I dropped the Pepto on the makeup table and slouched in my chair. "Darndest thing," I told him. "Oh yeah, what's that?" I told him about the guy in the bodega. When I got to the part about him comping me a bottle of Pepto, I could see the wheels mesh behind his eyes. "You know," he said. "What?" "Hold on." He walked out the door in costume. 15 minutes later, he returned with a fast food takeout bag. He tossed me a burger and sat on the couch to eat the other one. "I think we've stumbled on a gold mine," he said. I'm a normal guy. I have a conscience and everything. I knew what Sam proposed was immoral, disrespectful, and probably illegal. I went with this illegal part as my first argument. Not legal, Sam countered. We aren't pretending to be cops. We aren't handing out tickets or chasing after purse snatchers. We aren't trying to hold the thin blue line here. We're just in it for the donuts. Wearing cop uniforms. Are we? Really? Sam said. Uniforms, I mean? These are costumes, Davy. They come off a rack at Limelight Theatrical Supply. There's a guy over in Times Square in a Spider-Man getup. Nobody believes he actually slings webs and swings around Midtown hunting the Green Goblin. We work in the middle of the biggest adult amusement park this side of Vegas. Everyone's in costume in the city. Ours just happen to look kind of like cop uniforms. If we get caught, we'll be fired, I yelled. We're actors, Sam yelled back. Getting fired is part of the deal. I resisted. I really did. I put up the good fight for about a week. But Sam has always been sort of my Larry Mondella from Leave It to Beaver. Little by little, he always wore me down. He showed up with a fully dressed Italian hoagie from a specialty sub shop down the street and split it with me. I wavered, but ultimately held fast. The next night, he dropped half a Reuben in front of me on my dressing table from a deli down the street that always has a line out the door. My resolve was sorely tested, but I knew it would gnaw back at me all night if I stood firm. I think the breaking point was the pizza. About 5 days after he started, he showed up backstage with an 8-slice pepperoni and mushroom pie from one of New York's greatest shops. There's only so much a man can take. We need some ground rules, I said, as I shoved a folded slice of God's own za into my mouth. Ground rules, Sam mumbled through a mouthful of cheese and sauce. We do this all the time. We're going to get pinched, and then we're going to get fired. We have to be careful, maybe, okay, 2, no more than 3 times a week. Have you wondered what you might do if a couple of real cops show up? Yeah, pay for my food and tell them the truth. Thank them for their service and skedaddle. There's no shame in playing a cop on Broadway, Davy. We represent. He popped an iridescently golden bit of pizza crust into his mouth. So we started stepping out several nights a week for a bite on the cuff. After a while, it got to be a regular thing, and the backstage manager, Ernie, they're all named Ernie, it seems, just waved us through. I think he was sort of a co-conspirator because after a while we made sure to bring something back for him as well. He always made a show of refusing before eventually and inevitably relenting. I'm not proud of it. I mean, bit player salaries on Broadway are still pretty good. Nothing like Miss Thang, who's playing the blind chick in the play, of course, but win a couple of Oscars and you can write your own contract. Sam and I were getting by even without the uniformed mooching. We really didn't need to do it. So none of this was absolutely necessary, you see. I don't want to give the impression nobody forced me to do this. Though once I stopped being completely terrified of getting caught and maybe arrested, I had to admit it was fun. People see the uniform, not the man inside. They behave differently when the uniform is in the room. It's human nature. People were just so gosh darned polite and courteous. Behavior like that in a place like Manhattan, well, it's downright refreshing, if not a little addictive. Even so, we were careful. We never hit the same place twice in 2 weeks. We developed a sort of a circuit. Deli one night, pizza the next, burgers on the third. We carried cash in case things got dodgy or overwhelmingly awkward because some new kid was working checkout and wasn't in on the deal that cops eat free. Then came the night we nearly got caught. We had just stepped to the register at a sandwich place on 45th when 2 real NYPD officers walked through the door. They stared at Sam curiously for several seconds. I dipped into my pocket and held out my debit card to the checkout guy. "We're gonna be late," I scolded Sam. "I told you we were going to be late. Those bridesmaids aren't gonna strip for themselves." Did I mention I scored top of my class in improv at Juilliard? So we snuck by on that one. Barely. I think it rattled Sam a little because he stuck around the dressing room for several nights. I thought he might be depressed or maybe low blood sugar from relative starvation had gotten to him. It never occurred to me he might be deep in thought. On the fourth night, he sat up and snapped his fingers. "Skip the big places," he said. "Okay," I said. "Think about it. The more crowded a place is, the more likely it is somebody's going to get wise to us. Beat cops all eat at the big restaurants and diners. We specialize in bodegas and mom and pops." "You're still thinking about eating free, right?" I asked. "Because it sounds like you want to knock them over." We scaled back. Twice, maybe three times a week, we stepped out just after the first act, curtain up, headed to one of the five or six hole-in-the-wall eateries we'd scouted during the day, and to our surprise, the food was awesome. Turns out the tiny joints are built on family recipes that go back to the dawn of man, and the variety was better. I came to love Lebanese cooking, mutabal, fattoush, batahara, all of it. Sam developed a taste for Pakistani. We even tried our hand at takeout Ethiopian food, sopping up with spongy injera bread. Oh, it was all wonderful. By agreement, we never hit the same place more than twice. It prevented familiarity and assuaged my conscience. That meant constantly adding new places to the rotating list. Geography was a real factor as well. We couldn't wander too far afield, since we still had to return backstage by the end of Act One. The hardest part, for me, conscience-wise, was when they thanked me for my service. That tugged at my guilt strings and kept me awake at night. I told Sam I was out. Two or three times. Somehow he always dragged me back in. Weeks passed. It was a successful run, but all runs come to an end. And we got the notice in October. Miss Thang had to wig out to New Zealand to shoot some big-budget comic book superhero epic, and the producers had decided to close the show rather than recast her. We had about 2 weeks of gainful acting employment left before it was back to waiting tables and doing whatever improv, and driving Uber across the river in Hoboken until a new play came along. If it came along. "It's now or never," Sam declared backstage that night. "If we play this right, we can live on our accumulated fat for weeks." As we stepped out the back door, Ernie waved us through. "Not much for me this evening, boys. Just a Vendicott hot dog, something." Our target that evening was a Colombian sandwich shop that offered a South American take on paninis. We hadn't tried it before, but Sam read a bunch of good reviews on Yelp, so we decided to give it a try. Sam ordered a half a Cuban sandwich. I ordered something called Anna's Love with turkey, tomatoes, guacamole, grilled onions, and cheese with garlic sauce. It sounded good. It was a small place, maybe 15 feet wide and 40 feet deep. Might have been a shoe store back in the day. Places come and go. Half the width was taken up by the grill and register. The other side was wide enough for a single row of booths. Since we had to get back to the theater, we made our order to go. Two of the booths were occupied. I thought I saw the register guy nod toward them as he rang up our orders. "On the house," he said. "Thank you for your service." That taut wire in the gut twanged twice. For a moment, I lost my appetite. It returned by the time our order was ready. One of the booths emptied, and its occupants paid and left. The guy behind the bar glanced at the remaining occupied booth and nodded. I smiled and nodded back. "Hold on," Sam said. "Want to make sure it's all here?" He unwrapped the sandwich. I watched over his shoulder. No mustard. Sam wrapped the sandwich and returned to the counter. "I think you forgot something," he said. For a second, I thought the counter guy might faint dead away. He glanced again at the occupied booth and then at me. He nodded. I looked at the booth and back at him, and I shrugged. The two people in the booth stood and walked toward the cash register. Nervously, the counter guy checked them out and held the door for them as they left. He closed the door behind him.
"What's wrong with you?" he asked. "With people in the restaurant, are you that foolish?"
Sam glanced at me, question marks all over his face. I shrugged again. None of it made sense.
"All right, come with me," the man said, and gestured toward the kitchen prep area in a room behind the register.
We followed. He opened a cabinet over a hand sink and took out a thick envelope, which he handed to Sam.
"Tell him it's a little light. I can make it up next week."
"What?" Sam asked, a look of concern on his face. He was as puzzled as I was.
"Oh, okay, okay," the little guy said. "Not next week. By Friday. I can make it up by Friday."
"Hey, what's going on here?" I asked, leaning in. The guy slumped back against the wall, holding his hands up.
"Oh, don't hit me," he begged. "I'm sorry. I'm not holding back, honest. Here."
He ducked underneath me and dashed to the cash register, which he opened by punching the button so hard I could hear his knuckles crack.
"Here, from the till. I'll pay it all."
He stuffed another wad of bills into the envelope and pushed it into my hands.
"Please, just take it and go," he pled. "You tell the regular guys I cooperated. Don't forget your food."
Sam and I stared at one another for what seemed a year. He cocked his head and arched an eyebrow. I shrugged yet again. It seemed the most accurate gesture for my understanding. Reflexively, Sam stashed the envelope inside his jacket, grabbed the food, and we walked out into the street. We were back in our dressing room 15 minutes later. Would have been 10, but Sam had to stop off for a hot dog for Ernie. Sam took a bite of the Cuban sandwich and held up his hand to make the okay signal.
"Oh, delicious," he said. "Shame we can never go back there."
"What in the heck just happened?" I asked. "I believe that was a payoff." He extracted the envelope from his jacket and opened it. After counting the bills, he whistled. "Almost 500. "A payoff? For what?" Sam took another bite of the sandwich and made me wait as he chewed.
"I don't know.
Protection, maybe? Could be subletting the shop space from people who think rent means the same thing as tithe and like to be paid by the week. Could be the local beat cops are shaking down shop owners. Who knows? Only thing I know is we can't ever go back there, which is a shame because this is one primo sandwich."
"You're not thinking about keeping the money?" I asked.
"I plan to give you half."
"You can't do that. It's illegal money."
"Smells and spends like the legal stuff. What do you suggest?"
"I suppose we could take it back. We could explain to the nice panicked man that he handed the payoff money to a couple of soon-to-be unemployed actors. In fact, I'm sure the real cops have shown up by now and are very confused as to where their money is gone.
Let's give it back to them. I'm sure they'll take it off our hands, and 2 or 3 days later, they'll find our bodies under a pile of garbage on a barge headed for New Jersey. You know what? We keep it, and we never go out in costume again. Lesson learned. There are a million stories in the Naked City. This has been one of them." Somehow, he managed to say it with almost no sarcasm. And he was right. We stumbled onto something dangerous. Our best defense against it was to remain anonymous. We'd made our last mooch run. Our anonymity held for a little less than an hour. Our cues came. Sam and I dashed through the door with the sitcom actor playing the husband. We brandished our guns and told everyone to freeze. We fake-searched the place. Miss Thang and the sitcom dude embraced, and the curtain fell on performance number 142. Two men waited in the dressing room when we came off stage. They wore cheap suits and sour faces. They introduced themselves as soon as Sam and I came through the door. The tall, graying man was named Kelso. The shorter, sturdier man was Webb.
Apparently, their first names were both Detective. Webb did most of the talking. Kelso loomed above, watching.
You're Sam, Webb said, pointing to me. I shook my head. You're David, then, and that makes you Sam.
How do you know our names? Sam demanded.
Dude, I said, pointing. He's holding a theater program.
Webb faced me and reached out to finger the cop number 2 costume.
Nice, not realistic, but most people never notice details. Probably how you got away with it. You boys have been very, very naughty.
He did it first, Sam protested, pointing at me.
He's not talking about caging free meals, I said.
That's not entirely true, Webb said. We're kind of pissed about that, too. But you're mostly right. The money, please.
I grabbed the envelope from Sam's makeup bag and handed it over. Webb opened it and rifled the bills.
You didn't pocket any of it, he asked. His tone suggested it would be best if we hadn't.
Not a dollar, I said. No time. We had to get back before the end of Act 1. Look, we had no idea. We were just getting some food. The first time was an accident. I didn't expect the bodega owner would see my uniform and comp me. After that, it became sort of, a bad habit. But tonight, it was just about dinner. We had no idea the guy was going to hand us an envelope full of cash. Take it. It never happened, okay? Shoot, the play closes in a week. A month from now, I'll probably be doing dinner theater in Nebraska, far from here, and we have short memories.
Yeah, real short, Sam said. That's why we play walk-ons.
Webb handed the envelope to Kelso, who also examined it. He nodded.
Yeah, it's still tagged, he said. They didn't touch it.
Webb sat in Sam's makeup chair and rubbed his chin. I don't know what to do about you two. Tell me what you think went down tonight.
It was a payoff, right? Sam said. Dave said it was a payoff?
It was a payoff, Webb said. Somebody else was supposed to pick up the cash.
And bring it to you, I said.
Webb got red in the face. To me, what the heck, kid?
That's why you want the money, right? I ventured. You thought we had stolen it from you.
We knew you. Webb stopped.
Wait, you think this money was intended for me?
It isn't? Sam asked.
No, Webb said. But it wasn't intended for you either. This money was bait. Let's back this up.
Kelso and me were from Internal Affairs. You know what that means?
The Rat Patrol, Sam said, nodding.
Not helping, I cautioned.
No, Dave, he's right. Even the best-built house can become infested with vermin. There are over 38,000 uniformed officers in the NYPD. You think every one of them was an Eagle Scout? We need rat catchers in every organization. We help keep the department honest, and some people don't like that. So it's a double entendre, rat patrol, little rats catch big rats. We aren't popular, but we are effective.
You heard Detective Kelso say the money was still tagged?
Yeah, I said.
The shop owner is working with us. He made a complaint about cops who are acting as bagmen for some shady loan sharks. A lot of these guys come from whatever stand, you know. Don't have 3 nickels to knock against each other in their pocket. But they want to start a business. Electronics, restaurants, souvenirs, T-shirts, what have you. Banks won't touch them. You know who got really rich in the Yukon Gold Rush? It was the shopkeepers who sold axes and picks and wagons. There are loan sharks all over town, happy to finance a startup because they win either way. Either the borrower pays him back with usurious interest, or he goes belly up and the loan shark does the bust out and sells off the stock for pennies on the dollar. The guys we're tracking are working for one of them.
So when we showed up, the shop owner figured we were the bagmen?
I said. He was nervous because he knew he was setting them up and was afraid if he blew it, they'd hurt him, or worse.
That's very intuitive, Webb said.
Actor, motivation is kind of our thing.
It's a big part of ours as well, Webb said. So here's my problem. The guys, the real guys, showed up, and the money was already gone. Shocked the heck out of the guy running the store. The real cops were highly irritated. Made a lot of threats, tossing their weight around, but they left without doing any real damage or hurting the shop owner. So, we got nothing. If they'd picked up the money, the tag would still stick to them like tar until they handed it off to the loan shark. We establish a fiduciary relationship between the cops and the shark, and bibbidi-boppity-boo, they're civilians again, facing some jail time.
Yeah, but they didn't pick up the money, Kelso said. You boys did.
Yeah, I said, and we're really sorry, honest. We had no idea he was going to give Sam the envelope. We didn't figure out what was going on until we got back to the theater. We've been trying to decide what to do with it ever since. Take it. It's been nothing but trouble. Better off our hands. Well, boys, Webb said, that wasn't exactly the plan I had in mind.
It wasn't? Sam asked.
No, see, the shop we set up tonight is compromised. The real cops showed up to collect, and it was all upside down from there. For all they know, the guy is skimming or trying to avoid paying for a week. The real guys don't know for sure what the shop owner is telling the truth. He says two cops already picked up the money. They have to be asking, what two cops? They think some other uniformed officers might be ripping them off. What are they going to do? They can't call a cop, right? So they want to know who else is on the take and for who. Now things get really messy because Detective Culso and I are juggling about 6 IAD jackets each at any given time, and it's considered bad form to let one case ooze out all over the other. I don't want the cops I'm trying to catch right now to alert the cops I'll be trying to catch next week. Things like that cascades, and before you know it, all the rats have gone to ground.
Well, that makes sense, Sam said. Glad you think so, Webb said. Because my plan is this. I'll make sure these two guys were working on hear all about my collar of a couple of backstage Johnny Goldbricks who have been conning free meals from local diners while wearing theater costumes that look rather strikingly like the uniforms worn by our brothers in blue.
Wait, Sam said. So now you are arresting us for that?
Webb turned to me. He smokes a lot of weed, doesn't he?
Yeah, his share.
I think I follow you. Before the money was the bait, now we are the bait.
Yeah, it's more a little fish, big fish situation, Webb said. But yeah, ultimately, we want to draw these two yokels in and catch them either taking the money from you or engaging in other felonious behavior while trying to take the money.
Other felonious behavior? I asked.
Oh, you know, breaking, entering, armed robbery, assault and battery, manslaughter, Sam added.
No, we won't let it get to that. Believe me, the department frowns rather sternly on placing civilian informants in real danger. Mostly, we just talk the big game. So, this is how it's going to go down. You boys are going to continue your little con, only you'll hit the places we tell you to hit. Places where we know the guys we're investigating have collection agreements. We'll watch you every minute. Sooner or later, we'll make contact and try to get the money from you and maybe teach you a lesson about trespassing on their turf. That's when we sweep in and nab them. Any questions?
Yeah, Sam said. What if they lead with the teaching part?
At Juilliard, they taught us that the real work in acting comes long before you step on stage. We call it preparation. I discovered that actors have nothing on cops when it comes to preparation, especially preparation to trap wayward fellow officers in a sting operation. Kelso and Webb gave us a list of shops, with the dates on which they expected the rogue cops to drop by for their weekly payoffs. All we had to do was get there before them. The detectives left, and Sam and I started to remove our costumes and makeup. That was when Ernie dropped by our tiny dressing room door.
All right, just what are you boys up to? He asked, leaning against the door jamb.
What do you mean? Sam said, pulling his sport shirt over his head. Those two men who left here a few minutes ago?
Autographed hounds, I said.
The heck they were. I'm beginning to think maybe there's something fishy about all those snacks you boys were bringing me. Are you in some kind of trouble?
Nah, Ernie, Sam said. Everything's cool.
You two are green. So wet behind the ears.
I thought you went to Juilliard.
What's Juilliard have to do with that? I asked. Figured by now you'd be able to recognize bad acting when you see it.
Acting?
I said. Look, I've been in this business 23 years, man and boy. Got my start rigging lights up top a 40-foot ladder. I seen 'em come and go, and I know an actor from a mile away, even a lousy one. I've seen 'em on the way up, and I've seen 'em on the way down. Some of them is the same person. Thing is, nobody remembers an old fart stagehand. We don't register, except for good boys like you, who do me a favor now and then. I've seen it all, and something tells me you boys are in deep trouble.
Well, I appreciate the concern, Ernie, I said. Really, show's closing in a couple of weeks. We'll be headed up somewhere else. We'll be fine.
Uh-huh, Ernie said. Sure you will.
Detective Webb dropped by the dressing room just after we arrived the next evening. Sam and I had just started putting on our costumes.
Tonight's the night, he said. The fourth place on the list we gave you last night, it's about 2 blocks north and 1 west. You can get there in 5 minutes.
Where's Kelso? Sam asked.
He's already in place. Surveillance, you know.
I'll join him in a few minutes. We'll have eyes on you the entire time.
He left after confirming that we knew where to go. The stage manager dropped by to call places for the first act. That was our cue. Sam and I headed for the stage door where Ernie sat watching us.
Get you anything? I asked him.
Nah, no appetite, he said.
But thanks.
The address Webb gave us was a shawarma shop nestled between a nail parlor and a magazine stand. We walked through the door into a solid wall of Lebanese spice aromas. My mouth watered immediately. The place was empty, save for a man behind the counter, but I could hear voices in the kitchen behind a pair of swinging doors. Sam ordered a couple of sandwiches on pita and some falafel to go with it. The man disappeared briefly into the kitchen. Sam peered through the shop window.
"You see them?" he asked.
"Kelso and Webb?"
"Yeah."
"No, I'd be worried if I did. Relax. They're cops. They know what they're doing."
The counter guy returned from the kitchen with our sandwiches and falafel. Sam took the bag and looked inside.
You forgot something? He asked. He tried to sound tough.
Is there something wrong? The man said. Please, enjoy. On the house.
Something's missing, Sam said, hefting the bag up and down.
A light seemed to go on behind the man's eyes.
Oh, you aren't the usual.
He stopped abruptly and stepped back into the kitchen. Seconds later, he returned with an envelope.
Is this what you want?
I took the envelope and looked inside and then handed it to Sam, who also checked it.
Nice doing business with you, Sam said.
He pocketed the envelope and picked up the food.
We were halfway back to the theater when Webb and Kelso fell into step behind us.
Don't look around, Webb said.
Of course, Sam looked behind him.
We said don't look, Kelso said. The bust, it's not going down tonight. We just heard from one of the guys came down with the flu. Pickups are disrupted this week. Sorry, boys, but this one was a dry run. Turn at the next alley, okay?
They followed us into the alley. Sam leaned against the wall while I faced down Webb and Kelso.
We can't do this an unlimited number of times, I said. The show closes next week. The costumes will go back to the supplier.
Just hand me the envelope, Webb said. Evidence.
Evidence of what? A voice said. Two other men stepped into the alley. Both wore cheap, sturdy suits and thick-soled brogans. The taller of the two flipped a badge wallet. The other stood back, his hands under his jacket. Second later, Ernie followed them.
This guy?
The tall cop said to Ernie, pointing toward Kelso.
Yeah.
The tall one said,
Detective Kevin Comstock, NYPD. My partner's name is Sunday. Now what's all this about?
Minutes later, Webb and Kelso were in cuffs, and Comstock was reading us the riot act. He tossed out a number of offenses he could pin on us, beginning with impersonating cops. Sam tried his argument about representing, but Comstock shut him down. After ripping several layers of skin from our bones, he pointed toward Webb and Kelso and said, "These two idiots aren't cops either. Their names aren't even Webb and Kelso." Ernie stepped up.
"Hey, don't be too hard on them, Kevin. These are good boys, mostly. They just made some bad decisions sometimes."
"Will someone explain what's going on?" I asked. Comstock walked back to Sunday, who stood watch over Kelso and Webb.
"Like I told you, Ernie, nobody remembers stagehands.
That man, the one you called Kelso? Yeah, he was an actor, just like you boys. Name was Dennis Krebs. Had the same dressing room as you, maybe 15 years ago. Can't recall the play, but I never forget a face or a name. Soon as I saw him shaking you boys down, I knew something was wrong. Detective Comstock, well, he's an old friend of mine."
Comstock said, "You probably don't know it, boys, but Ernie here was on the job for 20 years before yanking the ripcord and becoming a stagehand. He was my training officer back when I was a rookie."
Ernie said, "I called Kevin, and he agreed to keep an eye on you, see that you didn't get into any real trouble. Then this Webb fella tries to muscle his way through the stage door on way to your dressing room tonight. Soon as he badged me, I knew he was a fake. He didn't know I used to wear one. I phoned Kevin and told him something was going down as soon as you two left the theater."
Comstock walked back to us. "Here's what we know," he said. "Krebs and the other guy, the one you know as Webb, have been running a protection scam on tiny hole-in-the-wall operators like the shawarma shop. Webb used to be a cop, but he punched out several years back. Guess he teamed up with Krebs sometime later. Webb knew all the angles, and Kelso, bad actor or not, could fake it. They saw you take an envelope of cash from one of their mocks. They thought you and your buddy would make perfect patsies, which you did. As long as they could send you in to make the pickups, nobody would see their faces. Sooner or later, you were bound to get busted, but since they were no detectives named Webb or Kelso, they figured no one would believe your story of helping the cops. They were using you. You were disposable."
"Are we in trouble?" I asked.
"You were conned, son," Comstock said. "Victims don't get prosecuted. However, there is a matter of impersonating police officers."
"That's over, man," Sam said. "Never again. Only on stage, and the show closes in a few days. For all we know, we'll be playing shepherds in a month, or cowboys, or doctors. No more cops, scouts, honor. Right, Dave?"
"Maybe not," I said. I turned to Detective Comstock. "Suppose I was getting tired of living hand-to-mouth in the theater life. Would you be hiring?"
Sam is in Hollywood now. I wish I could say he's made a big splash, but why lie? He's driving Uber and grabbing movie extra gigs when he can. But to hear him tell it, he's as happy as a starving clam. More power to him. Me? Well, I joined the NYPD. I wear blue now and carry a real badge, and I never exploit the comps from merchants. And as it turns out, the whole Juilliard thing may have not been wasted after all. Seems guys with college degrees, even degrees in theater, get fast-tracked for a detective's gold shield. That's my goal these days. For now, though, I still work the Great White Way. Broadway is my beat. All right, Matt Coward out of the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine brings us our next story, and it's called What Is Your... with three dots and a question mark after it. Guilty pleasure? I have always had to struggle with myself to avoid answering child molestation and fox hunting to this one, because really, why on earth would a pleasure be guilty? What dismal Puritan world are we living in where enjoyment, rather than crime or sin, induces guilt? Unless, indeed, your pleasures are child molestation and fox hunting, in which case, well, fair enough. I used to put dozing in the sun with a large glass of cheap red when I'm supposed to be learning my lines. But my agent says I'm now at an age where I don't want to give off dozing vibes. In case people get stuck with a mental image of me as someone slightly sleepy, not as young and as virile as I was in my heyday, perhaps even someone who can't be relied on to learn lines because his sentience inclines him toward somnolence. Thanks, Janet. So, my current answer to guilty pleasure is long lazy walks across the heath with my three rescue dogs. My ex-wife laughed herself silly the first time she read that one. "The thought of you with three dogs is absolutely gorgeous, darling," she said. "I mean, the idea of you having one dog would be delicious, but three is pure comedy gold. Absolute platinum." Mocking me was always her guilty pleasure, although I doubt she ever felt guilty about it. Regret, perhaps, right at the end. Not guilt. At one point, I changed it to three-legged rescue dogs, because if you're going to lie, at least give people something to cheer. But my agent, Janet, changed it back. I can't complain. The main point of an agent, I have realized over the years, is to protect you from your own instincts. What is your chief failing? Now, for years, this was perfectly straightforward. I give too much of myself to others, or perhaps I am too trusting. But in recent times, people have begun, if you can believe it, to sneer at such heartfelt revelations. It's all part of the awful cancer of cynicism that's eating away at the nation's relationship with its public figures. These days, I tend to put something like, I'm not good at relaxing. I've never been able to do nothing. I always seem to be on the go, constantly have a dozen projects in hand at once, and downtime is something that happens, well, to other people. The message is, just because you haven't seen me on the telly for 18 months doesn't mean I'm unemployed. I've got all sorts of irons in the fire that civilians like you don't know about and probably wouldn't understand if you did. The first time I received one of these magazine questionnaires, I was ecstatic. I've made it, I thought. I'm a celebrity. Ordinary people with mundane lives long to know the name of my first family pet. Of course, before long, I realized that real celebrities never fill these things in. They're too busy being, well, real celebrities. It's people like me, the middling sort, the vaguely known, the not quite anonymous who spend half their lives answering, "What is your earliest memory?" with some anodyne old balls about helping your dear widowed granny stir the Christmas pudding in her humble miner's cottage. In the 20 years since I became a semi-recognizable face and name, oh yes, he played one of the junior doctors in that BBC thing, didn't he? Or am I thinking of that other guy? I must have done 200 celebrity confessions, women's magazines, TV guides, weekend newspaper supplements. At the back, there's always someone you've more or less heard of giving two-line answers to one-line questions with both Q's and A's, consisting of trivia disguised as insight. I suppose it's the grown-up version of the pop mags from my youth, where teen idols would reveal their horoscope sign or their favorite color. Having said that, I have, in fact, been asked my horoscope sign. Before now, I made one up. Farcisa. What single possession would you most hate to lose? The truth is, I would be most upset not to know the current whereabouts of my boning knife. But what you're supposed to put is, one thing I've learned in life is that possessions mean nothing. There isn't any object I couldn't live without. Love, health, and work, that's all that matters. Sometimes, though, you know how it is. Boredom sets in. Once when Janet was on holiday, I answered with my collection of Jack the Ripper memorabilia. She went bloody mental when she got back from the Maldives. And to be fair, she was right. And she always is. One should not complete these things when one is drunk. For the next 6 years, I was getting unsolicited correspondence from the most dreadful weirdos. Where are you at your happiest? The rule on this one is perfectly clear. You have to say, at home. If you're a woman, you have to say, at home with my beautiful boys, even if you've got daughters. If the questionnaire is for a high-priced magazine, it's entirely acceptable to make it clear that the home in question is only one of many. Oh, at our cozy flat in Belgravia, or else at our sweet little beach place in Surfside, Florida. But whatever, it has to be home. In my notorious drunken quiz, when Janet was away, I wrote, hanging upside down in Madame Nasty's torture dungeon, and the bastards printed it. Even then, I think most people would have got that it was a joke if it hadn't been for my ex-wife going around telling everyone that this had been the main reason for their divorce. Cost me a long run in a West End kiddie show, that did, and nobody will ever convince me it didn't. How could it have been the drinking? Nobody's ever sober in the kiddie shows, and that includes the parents in the audience. Anyway, cut and paste. At home in my broken-down artisan cottage in the Lake District, in front of a roaring fire, with a gale howling outside and a good book on my lap. No electricity, no phone reception, and the water comes from a well. It's, oh, paradise on earth. Needless to say, I would die if I ever so much as set foot in such a place. It has to be a good book, by the way, not just a book. A book could be anything, could be porn, could be coloring in. I mean, it could be a whodunit. What worries you? What keeps you awake at night? If you think about it, this is the stupidest question of them all. Isn't it the same for everyone? You worry about things you've done. And even more so, you worry about things you've left undone. You know you're not perfect, and your plans aren't flawless, and your actions can never be entirely without consequences. You know that all you can ever do is your best, and that, in practice, all you usually end up doing is your, well, second best. You go over everything, don't you? You lie there, going over it all, minute by minute, step by step. Did I really say that? Oh my goodness, did I really do that? Will anyone remember? What keeps you awake? For heaven's sake, what a question. Anyone who sleeps through the night after the age of about, 17 must suffer from daily amnesia. The best thing about being an actor is you work evenings and you sleep during the day with the lights on. I worry about a lack of diversity among the leadership in the profession. Yes, that's fine. Very much the sort of thing my questionnaire persona would fret about. Might be worth trying to work in. I have led a very privileged life in so many ways, and I worry about those less fortunate. At some point, under hobbies perhaps? Do you remember your first day at school? There are never any new questions. That's partly why these things are so irritating. The same dull questions time after time, the same dull and dishonest answers. They all borrow them from each other, I imagine. The question setters, I meant, though you could probably say the same about the answerers. My agent says I have to do the quizzes because they keep me in the public eye. But do they? Do they really do that? I'd have thought the best way of keeping me in the public eye would be for my agent to give me better parts. But there you are. What do I know? I don't remember my first day at school because, well, I was so drunk. Ah, the heck with it. I'm going to send that in, and they don't like it, they can cut it out. I had 8 years of marriage during which I wasn't allowed to make jokes. Now I'm a penniless, divorced loser. I can at least express myself. What is your greatest achievement? Well, that's a dodgy one for me because I don't have any children, and my children is, of course, the correct answer. Heart before head right now, I'd go for my alibi, but more sensibly, I think we'll stick with the usual faux modesty. Oh, simply making it this far. Sadly, many of my contemporaries haven't. That poignant touch at the end is very good. I'm pleased with that. Plus, I always try to work in the least one private gag to make the process more bearable. Did you have a mentor in your early days? And who was it? Trick question. I always leave this one blank. If you say no, you're basically boasting. Oh, I did it all on my own. Behold me, the self-made success. If you say yes, you then got to name some long-dead idiot that you worked with for 2.5 days a half a lifetime ago, thus offending all the other idiots who you have just told the world left no impression on you whatsoever. No, thank you. Next one, please. What do you most regret? I very nearly typed, not doing it earlier, which would have been genuinely indiscreet. Manufactured indiscretion is inherent in these things, obviously. I have struggled with self-worth issues for much of my life, is a favorite of the blowhard, the braggart, the self-adorer. But revealing actual truths would be an error under any circumstance. My marriage comes under that heading, too, so this entry needs a good 10 minutes of thinking time. 2 glasses of wine later, I slap my head with the obviousness of it. Ugh, my old dad didn't live to see my successes on television and stage, including my 4 award nominations, and he would have been so proud. I feel the pain of that every day. Technically defensible, if anyone ever wanted to quibble, in point of fact, the graceless old miser died on the night of my 3rd nomination, Best Supporting Actor Male Ongoing Series in the TV Crazy Reader's Poll, which meant I had to miss the ceremony. I'm not saying he did that on purpose, I'm just saying he would have done it if he could. What quality do you most dislike in other people? Meanness, jealousy, pettiness, the carrying of grudges long after the people involved have gone their separate ways and at least one of them is trying to move on. Revenge-seeking, gossip-mongering, litigation, greed, take your pick, really. Final answer? Oh, bad manners. I try to treat everyone with respect. How fit are you? As it turns out, fitter than I thought. If you were a beetle, which one would you be? Is this a typo? Do they mean John Paul George or Ringo, or do they mean Stag, Colorado, Longhorn, or Dung? I wonder if there's a beetle named after a beetle. That'd be a pretty clever answer. Perhaps too clever, though. I leave it. You can generally get away with blanking about 6 questions without annoying the editors. Not more than that. If you no comment the whole interview, someone's going to get suspicious. Do you still have any unfulfilled ambitions? Not now, no. One piece of advice for a young person starting out on the same road as you. There's nothing you can do about motive. You can't wear gloves against motive. You can't dispose of motive by throwing it in the canal. If you've got motive, you've got it. You're stuck with it. And that's that. Just brazen it out and concentrate on getting the rest right. Have you ever dreamt your own death? I have, as it happens. Quite frequently, though, I'd never say so because I don't know what it signifies. For all I know, the only people who die in their dreams are psychopaths, or serial killers, or theatrical has-beens. I don't believe myself to be any of those things, but there's no point in sowing doubt in other people's minds. What's the definition of an understudy? Well, someone who dies in someone else's dreams. What have you heard lately that has literally made your jaw drop, good or bad? Well, since you ask, it was discovering that my ex-wife had installed a motion-sensitive hidden camera in her bedroom and, which is more to the point as well as being almost beyond my belief, in her living room, for the purpose of recording her love life. She wasn't that adventurous when she was married to me, that's all I can say. When did you last cry? See above? The sheer quantity of genius I expended on that alibi, all rendered redundant by a 50-quid piece of techno junk and a delusional, middle-aged woman's horrible perversions. Who wouldn't cry? Where were you on the 19th August between 9 p.m. and midnight? Ah, well, at least someone's come up with a new question. Well, folks, that's it for our actors-themed show on the Mystery Hour. I'm Keith Toller, your broadcaster, saying thanks for joining me, and please do tune in again next time, if you would. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.